The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Inspiring interviews with today's top landlords. This is the Rental Income Podcast. And now, Dan Lane.
I love hearing stories from people that have been successful owning rental properties, but the truth is there is risk involved in this, and people do lose money. And I think it's important every once in a while to bring those people on the show to hear their story and to figure out what they did wrong so that we don't make the same mistakes. My guest on the podcast today made a lot of mistakes. He did a lot of things wrong, but in all fairness, he had a lot of bad luck happen at the same time. The combination of the two was just disaster. Things went really bad and he lost a lot of money. So today on the show, we're going to hear his story and hopefully you can learn some things today and make sure that you don't make the same mistake. So let's take a real quick break. We'll come back in 30 seconds and we'll meet Jason Bangeter from Utah.
Are you on track to achieve your financial goals? Income-producing real estate is the most historically proven way to accumulate wealth and has created more financial freedom than any other means. Norada Real Estate provides everything you need to invest in the best turnkey cash flow rental properties. Our simple proven system will help you create real wealth and passive monthly income. Get your free strategy session with our knowledgeable investment counselors at noradarealestate.com. That's N-O-R-A-D-A realestate.com.
Hey, Jason, welcome to the podcast. Why don't we start with you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you first got started in real estate?
Sure. I started as a person buying homes and flipping them. I owned an agency and I took the money I made from that and did a lot of flipping. When the music stopped in 2007, I owned several properties and became a landlord. I needed some way to pay my mortgages on those properties, and being a landlord seemed to be the best way to do that.
So what happened? Were the flip properties were done, and then the market just kind of collapsed, and you couldn't sell the properties for what you needed to?
Yeah, so I was in the middle of a couple of projects. One of them ended up being a 6,800 square foot, $1.3 million house. And the other one was a $1 million house. And they weren't really set up for traditional rentals. So I decided I would do a vacation rental. And I saw a sign for vacation rentals on the street over from my property. One of my properties. And so I went out and invested $60,000 in furniture and started furnishing the place. And Airbnb had not come around yet. And so I went on VRBO and started finding people to come in and rent my properties.
Now, you've got a lot of money in this property. So you've got over $1 million in the property. Is that right?
Yes.
So you've got over
$1.3 million.
Just for the property, and then an extra $60,000 for furniture.
Yes, I had to actually provide things like towels, plates, things to cook with. I had two kitchens in this property. It's really high end. And even things like shampoo.
Right. Yeah, you don't think about that stuff. That there is a lot of things that go along with just doing the house. I mean, it's not like a regular rental where you're just providing the house. When you're doing a vacation rental, there's so much more that goes into it. So you've got the house furnished, you've got all the supplies and everything. Was it a lot of work? Or I guess, did you think it was going to be a lot of work to keep people in the property and to keep things going?
No, I thought it'd be pretty easy. There's a few challenges, so I'll just give you a few of them. One of the first challenges I discovered was just keeping the supplies restocked. And I had to, every time someone used the property, I had to personally come up and restock things like toilet paper, make sure we had clean dishes and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I actually hired a maid service, and they started coming in and doing things, but they weren't used to doing things like refilling shampoo or
right.
Or that kind of thing. They were just used to cleaning. So I became my own maid service.
Wow. So you were going to the house between guests and actually cleaning yourself every time?
Yeah, I would do that in combination with the maid service. But what really got crazy is when someone would leave, let's say in the morning, I'd be at work. And then later on that afternoon, I'd have a new guest coming in.
Right.
And so the crazy part about that is I'd have to coordinate filling up, you know, the supplies. And I'd get my wife and young daughter to run up to the house, and it quickly became more work than we thought it would.
So was it profitable? I mean, because this sounds like a really nice house. It's in a nice location. You've got a lot of vacation travelers. Were you making money on it, or was it just breaking even because you had such a large mortgage on the property?
Yeah, so that's a great question. When I calced it out now, I was making around $2,500 a month in profit.
Okay. All right.
That sounds pretty good. And then you start realizing what you were doing, because I didn't include my time in that
right.
in that time period, or my wife's time or my daughter's time. And not to mention, I also ran into some other challenges.
Like what else?
Well, that sign that I mentioned that was just down the street and said vacation homes for rent, I didn't realize that the city ordinances applied to that little part of the area and not my neighborhood. And this was a small neighborhood, so to speak. It only had about 8 houses on it, and it was on the side of a mountain overlooking the whole Salt Lake Valley, only 9 minutes to the ski resort. So it's a perfect place to put a ski vacation home.
Right.
But about 3-4 months into this, everything seemed to be going smoothly. And then the cops showed up talking to my guests.
Wow. So they shut you down because it wasn't permanent, or was it just not legal to have a vacation property in that neighborhood?
Yeah. So the ordinance has stated that you could have a vacation home in the properties next door, but in my neighborhood, you could not.
Wow.
The only thing you could have is rentals longer than 30 days. So anything shorter than that was illegal. And my neighbors got upset, and the police came to me, and I actually had another guest booked right behind that. And then they showed up to that guest, and then they came to me and said, "You do this again, we're going to have problems."
You know, that's a really good thing to point out, because I know a lot of people are attracted to Airbnb or vacation rentals because, I mean, it's more work, but, you know, it can be a lot more profitable. But you have no control if the city outlaws it after you buy the property, that you can't do it anymore, or in this case, you were never allowed to do it. So I think that's a really good thing to point out to people, to make sure that you can actually rent out a property short term before you do it. Looking back on it now, is there any way that you would have known that? Like, how would you even know that you couldn't do this?
That's a good question. I looked around and tried to do that research beforehand, and I didn't see anywhere that it indicated. As a matter of fact, that sign that I mentioned was permanent, and it's still there today on the street, right?
Wow.
Like literally within 100 feet of the street I was on. And
wow.
So the ordinance, when the police talked to me, they said, "Oh, unfortunately it doesn't apply to this street." And
right.
I mean, it just was kind of mind blowing. So there was a lot of furniture and time wasted. And there's some other antidotes with that. For instance, I had one guest leave, and there was about a month between guests. So I was just so busy at work, I thought, well, I got a month, I'm not even gonna worry about this. About 4 days before that rental came up, I showed up on the property just to make sure we could get it all cleaned up and it was ready to roll. And I walked in, and my house was super warm. And I thought, well, that's weird. I went in and the fireplace was still rolling from the previous guest a month before.
Oh my gosh. Wow. That must have been a huge gas bill for that month, right?
It was really expensive.
Yeah, I bet.
And the house is 6,800 square feet, so it was on high. So that house was very warm for about a month with no one in it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really the biggest down. And I'm actually really glad that we're talking about this, because sometimes Airbnb can sound good or maybe even look better on paper than a traditional rental. But you don't always hear these stories about the small things that can really not make it as easy as a regular rental. So I'm glad you're sharing this with us. So how did you move on from that? So you get shut down, and then did you turn the property into a regular rental?
I did. I turned the property into regular rental, albeit with $60,000 of really nice furniture in it. And it didn't quite cover the mortgage. So I was supplementing this rental for quite a while. And what I really wanted to do was just sell it. I didn't see the economy turning. By this time, it was 2011. Even though my renters were great, I didn't really have any issue with them. I decided to put it on the market for sale. And a real estate agent was working with me, and everyone remembers the economy in 2011. It was probably the bottom of the economy. And the real estate agent came to me and said, "Hey, I've got this a renter, they want to buy your property." And I said, "Well, I'd like to meet him first." So I went in and met this potential renter. And I remember going to the house they were living in, and I'm a car guy. And in the driveway was this guy's Porsche 911 GT3 RS, which is a race car. And I was kind of, I think I was mystified by that car, because when I walked in, he said, "Hey, I'm so-and-so, and I want to rent your property. We're just moving from here and we just need to find a place to rent." I said, "Well, that's great. By the way, I like your car." And I talked to the agent. I ended up paying her a massive commission. And this guy moved in. But before he moved in, I just used the contract I'd found off the internet. And that's when some troubles began.
Wow. All right. So let's get into this. So first of all, you didn't do any kind of a background check on him. You just said, "Well, he's got a nice house. He's got a nice car. This guy seems like he's going to be a great tenant," right? Was that the extent of your background check?
Yeah, I that was pretty much it. I looked at him right in the eye, and you know, he didn't blink. So I figured he must be good for his word. So
did you?
That was my whole background check.
Did you verify his income or anything else to make sure he could afford it? Or?
I didn't. I just looked around at what he had, and the agent I was using only worked with high-end clients, and she said he checks out. He's a good guy. He just needs a they've sold their house, so he needs a rental for a while. I said, "That's great. That sounds like the ideal person." He said, "Actually, he's really interested in buying your house." So I kind of got hooked on this idea that he would purchase my home after rent.
Right. So you would rent it to him for a little bit, and then at some point he's going to want to buy it. Did he promise you a high price to buy the property?
He didn't. He didn't get into that.
Okay.
He just said he'd like to see what he thinks about the house, and then he definitely was interested in the property if everything checked out.
Now, to try to get in your head at the time, I'm sure that you've got some pressure because you've got this big mortgage payment. You want to get a tenant in there, and you've got a guy that is going to give you money right away to move in. And he's also your exit plan. So I can see that. Am I right that's kind of what you were thinking at the time?
100%. And remember, it's 2011, the bottom of the economy.
Right. Right. Okay. So the guy moves in, and I think we can both agree that you did that screening 100% wrong, right? I mean,
yeah, 100% wrong.
So he moves in, and so what happens? What was what was the first thing, the first red flag when he moved in?
Well, everything went smooth. And I thought, wow, this is going to be great. The last tenants I had, I ended up telling them they had to leave, but they were great tenants. So I thought, well, this guy's going to move in. He pays me a little bit more and he's going to buy my property.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 or 4 months go by. So I think it's month four and he hadn't paid me rent.
Wait, he hadn't paid you at all in 4 months?
Yeah. Well, he had paid me the first 3 months, but month four, he hadn't paid me.
Okay.
Rent. So I went in and looked at the bank account and, he hadn't paid. So I went in and talked to him and I said, hey, you just haven't paid yet. And he's like, oh yeah, I'm going through some troubled times. You know, can we just push that out a bit? I said, no, no problem. We had a rapport at this point, so I figured that would work out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then the next month came around, month five, and then what happened then?
Same kind of thing. He said, listen, you know, I no longer, the company I was running, I'm no longer doing it. I'm trying to figure this out. Can you just let me float a little bit? I said, yeah, but, you know, I got this mortgage. And he said, well, I can give you some money. And this was, I didn't know this at the time, but this was a strategy he had in order to stay in the home longer. And the strategy was to pay me a little bit of money. So it shows that I've accepted, quote, rent. And that allowed him to stay in the house a little, you know, at least another month because I've accepted some form of payment.
Right.
Even if you accept a dollar, you in this place anyway, I had to keep him in the house.
Yeah. You know, so let's talk about that because that's something that I've done before where a tenant has said they don't have the money to pay the rent. I've never let it go into a second month, but they've said that they don't have the full rent on the first, but they can pay me part of the rent, maybe half of the rent now, and then they'll pay the next half when they get paid. And that's always worked out for me, but I've always had kind of a clear plan on what they're going to do and had the tenant agree to it. But in your case, the guy gave you some money, but there's no clear plan. He didn't really necessarily know when he was going to have the rest of the money. It's just, I don't have it now. Here's some money. Go away. Right? Is that kind of...
Yeah, but... Yeah, you're absolutely right. I wasn't thinking about it at that time. Remember, the economy's still horrible.
Yeah.
He said, I'll be able to get you caught up. Don't worry about this, that sort of thing. And I was a little naive and didn't realize that that's what I was working myself into as a big problem.
Right. So for that month five, he gave you the partial payment and then that was it. You never got anything else for that month?
Yeah, nothing more that month. I called him up and said, hey, can you make those 2 months? And he said, well, you know, end of that month. And he said, I don't have the whole payment. And I was still trying to be nice because he said, you know, my wife and I have decided this is the house we want to move into and we want to buy from you. And I said, oh, okay. And he's like, well, I just got to get on my feet again. And this guy's the CEO of his old company. So,
right.
And remember, he's got that GT3 RS parked in my garage.
Right, right.
So I think he's, you know, really good for it.
Right.
And I accept a little bit of money on month three. And then that's it.
Wow. So that's it? Like, you didn't get anything else after that?
Yeah. So
wow.
Month four rolls around of this kind of nonsense. And he just said, I'm sorry, I just can't even pay you. So at that point, I think just like anyone, you'd look at the contract that you just signed with him.
Yeah.
Well, this is a contract I just found on the internet that had no kind of vetting. And come to find out, the contract was full of holes.
Wow.
And when I look at a deal, I don't try to do a win-lose. I try to always do a win-win. And
right.
In this case, it was really a lose for me. And this contract was just full of nonsense. So I didn't have the ability. I looked into it and I was trying to, you know, figure out, okay, can I give him an eviction notice? Well, the contract didn't really have some of those provisions in it. And the long story short is he ended up being in my property for a total of 9 months of non-payment.
Wow.
Or a couple of partial payments. And at the end, I ended up having to hire an attorney, and we were able to kind of strong arm him with this attorney to finally get him out of my property. Essentially, wow. I had a high-end squatter.
Yeah.
But
wow.
even worse, he had taken some of my furniture out of the house and gave it to his business partner because his business partner said he wanted to buy it. And long story short, he had some of my furniture in his property, and his business partner now had some, and they were using it. And most of that furniture just disappeared.
Oh my God.
And I then had to pay attorney to just get him out. And at this point, you know, I just kind of washed my hands of that bad experience. And it became a turning point, a lesson for me that number one, you need to understand credit and background checks. If you're going to do, be a landlord, they're almost, I would say the most critical part of being a landlord, understanding what they do for you, and how they work versus just assuming that a credit and background check is all the same, because they're
right.
not.
Right. So what do you think total you lost between the mortgage payments you had to pay, the attorney fees, lost furniture? Like, how much did you lose on this property?
I calced it out at $35,000 to $36,000.
Wow. Insane. That absolutely insane. So did you sell the property then when you finally got him out?
Yeah, I finally got him out, and it took a while to find someone to buy it, but we finally found someone to buy it about 6 months later.
Wow. And were you able to break even when you sold it, or did you lose even more just because
no.
of the market? Wow.
No, I took a bath on that house. I ended up selling that property. And keep in mind, I borrowed $745,000 for the house to be built. And we were a year late. It was supposed to be finished in June of 2007. It was finished in June 2008. And by the time I sold it, it was the end of 2011, 2012. And I sold it for $640,000. The rest of the money came out of my pocket.
Wow, that's tough. That hurts. That
yeah.
really hurts.
The salt's in the wound right now.
Yeah, yeah. But I think the good thing, if there's anything good that came out of that, it's just being able to share this story on this podcast. And, you know, hopefully somebody listening will avoid making the same trouble.
Oh, for sure.
But that is horrible. And so the other good thing that came out of this is this led you into your business. So
it did.
Tell me about Rentler. Now, Rentler is a sponsor of the podcast, but Jason is not paying to be on the show today. But Jason, can you just tell us, I'm sure everyone is a little bit familiar with Rentler. They've heard the commercials on the podcast, but tell us about Rentler and what you do now.
Yeah. So as any entrepreneur, and I've got three businesses, including Rentler, and I look at a problem and I start immediately trying to solve that. And as a landlord and as a tenant, I look at it, I put my both shoes on. I don't like to look at it from one side. I like to see how would someone want to be treated. They want to be treated just like I would, with respect, and let's find a win-win. And so Rentler was really born out of the idea that there was no software at the time to manage your property from a landlord perspective. And there was no way to really get great tenants or find properties on a listing service. Craigslist is obviously out there, and there's some others. But a lot of those I found to be the listings are old, or they're just not, you can't do a search on those. And as a landlord, I started realizing that you can't, you know, let's say you look at Craigslist and you want to sell a couch. Well, when you sell it, you delete the ad, or you have to always repost over and over again. So you're playing this thing I call King of the Mountain. And if you want your ad to be looked at, you always have to repost. And the first thing we did was we created a listing service. And unlike a couch that you're trying to sell on Craigslist, we wanted the ability to turn off the listing and have all the information there, including all your photos, your description, and then turn it back on when it's time to list.
Which is, I think, a great feature of Rentler, that because you get a tenant in there, when you turn the listing back on a year later when that tenant moves out, you've got your pictures in there, you've got your descriptions. It takes just a couple of seconds to get the listing up.
Yeah, it's fabulous. It saves people time. I was running my agency at the same time I was renting these properties, and I remember being such a pain to take a break and be like, oh man, I got to get my listing to the top of the list. So I'd go and relist it. So that was just one thing we solved.
That's awesome. And tell me more about what you guys do. So you've got the listing, but that's not all. You guys do a lot of other stuff too for landlords.
Yeah. So the other big problem I had as a landlord, obviously I explained my experience as a landlord getting the wrong tenant in. Landlords that do it yourself typically don't take applications. So the first thing we did was we created an application that on the listing you can apply as a tenant. And if I'm a tenant, I don't like to go fill out the application over and over mm-hmm. and over again. I'd love to get one application filled out and then send it to multiple properties as I'm trying to vet out where I'm trying to go as a tenant. And that just made a lot of sense to me. Mm-hmm. So rather than just that redundancy, we built that application. But the other big thing was I learned a lot about credit and background checks, and they're not all equal. So I wanted to create the ultimate credit and background checks. We teamed up with Experian, and we came up with this idea that the tenants can pool their own credit and then share it with their landlord. And the reason that's important, because I couldn't become a landlord that could pull people's credit without paying an inspector to come inspect my office to make sure I had a fax machine for some reason and a filing cabinet with a lock on it, amongst other requirements to become an individual that can pull people's credit.
Yeah.
And so we just had the unique way of thinking about this and be able to pull it from the consumer side and then share it with the landlord.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I mean, it's a really, really great portal for landlords. If you're not on there already, you should definitely check it out. It's rentler.com, rentler.com. Well, Jason, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you sharing your story.
Yeah, you bet. I really, really appreciate taking the time to listen to there's some good things about being a landlord, and then there were some things I really learned the hard way. And hopefully you don't have to learn the hard way.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back with a new interview next Tuesday. My name is Dan Lane, and this has been the Rental Income Podcast.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcast-free today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcast-free.